You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
Well, hey, everyone. Before we get started on today's episode, two quick announcements. First, there are those who say listening to an audiobook doesn't count as reading. To those people, I'll say the same thing as I would to people who argue that being a Christian doesn't count unless you believe in inerrancy. Just go look at history. For hundreds of years, humans got their information from someone reading a book out loud. You might say it's more normal than reading silently to yourself. But if you still feel like listening doesn't count, then this announcement is not for you. It's for normal people. So I'm happy to announce that the audiobook version, Jonah for Normal People, is finally out, and it's read by yours truly, who happens to also be the author. So check it out anywhere you get audiobooks. Jonah for Normal People, it's now available. Second, you might notice over the next few weeks that our podcast now has ads on it. We hope this doesn't offend too many people, but we are excited to take a step toward having the podcast be more sustainable. Now, given how amazing everything is that we do at the Bible for Normal People, you might from the outside think that we're a giant corporation, but we are in fact but a humble few who've been doing this part-time as a side hustle to our other occupations for the past 6 or more years. So hopefully this will help us hustle a little less, but also we're excited about new ways we can bring the best in biblical scholarship to everyday people, but those ways unfortunately cost money. So in addition to our campaigns and the courses and classes we offer and the wonderful folks at Patreon, we're giving ads a try. It might feel clunky for a few weeks as we get our feet wet with it. We'd appreciate your grace. Also, stay tuned for ways you can continue to get the podcast ad-free. We should be announcing that in the next couple of weeks as well. Thanks everyone for your support. Let's get back to the show.
Achtung, es folgt eine wichtige Botschaft Ihres Mobilfunkanbieters.
Ey Mann, es gibt Leute, die drücken immer noch zu viel Knete ab.
Nein, nicht frisch.
Ne Barra ist ja irgendwie smarter.
Ja, smart.
50 Gigabyte für nur 8,99.
Wenig Knete.
Ich zahle doch nicht mehr für weniger.
Nee, das wäre auch schön blöd.
Le
Barra, deine Knete, deine Entscheidung.
Nice.
Alle Details zu unseren Tarifen finden Sie unter lebara.de.
Für alle ein Fest zum Aldi-Tiefpreis. Volvic Naturell, 1,5 Liter für nur 49 Cent, zuzüglich Pfand. Oder Almare Räucherlachs XXL, 220 Gramm für nur 3,49 Euro. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
Well, hey folks, welcome to this episode, this joint episode, meaning Jared and I together, just yakking about something that just very spontaneous, although we thought about it a great deal.
What does that even mean? It's a spontaneous episode that we've thought about a great
deal. It's a paradox, Jared. Come on.
Embrace the mystery.
Paradox.
Embrace the mystery.
Embrace it, for heaven's sake.
Okay, well, what we're going to talk about today is the center of the Hebrew Bible, which some people might think we would talk about a number of things.
Yeah.
But I think it's going to be surprising what we talk about, and that is the centrality of the monarchy.
Yeah. Boring. No. Wrong. Not boring.
And, you know, one of the reasons I thought it would be good to talk about this was growing up, the Bible is ill-fitted for some of the things that we try to make it do. Hmm. It becomes this devotional where everything is supposed to give us like this life lesson, and it's supposed to make us like feel good. It'd be full of like inspirational quotes. And it can be frustrating with how much of it's filled with stories that seem very irrelevant to us several thousand years later.
Yeah. Like, speaking of the monarchy, Second Kings especially is all like,
yeah,
well, that was horrible. That didn't work.
And then this king did
the same thing, and we're in exile. And the whole purpose is like, well, let's not do that again, you know? And it you know, it's hard to find. I don't mind saying this. I think it's very hard to find true spiritual, devotional excitement for us as Christians reading certain parts of these stories. But that doesn't mean they're not really, really important to how the Hebrew Bible works, which is really the point of this. It isn't what we like or what we get out of it. It's just looking more, let's say, from a 30,000-foot view, somewhat objectively, and saying, why are we saying the monarchy is central to the Hebrew scriptures?
Right. And yeah, I think that's exactly right, is also just acknowledging that reality. Because I think, again, sometimes we just want to, because they like, oh, well, yeah, and then there's some kings and stuff. It's like, well, this takes up a big chunk of our Bible. Yeah. And it's important to understand that and understand why and understand how that might actually impact other parts of our Bible as well.
Right, right. So the monarchy, you know, there are different ways of parsing this out. But if we look at the books of the Hebrew Bible, most of the books are dealing with the monarchy in one way or the other. I mean, the books that are most central to it are 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings.
And then we get a recapitulation in 1st and 2nd Chronicles.
Right, which is, Jews don't think of it in the same way that we do. We'll get to that in a second. Yeah. But so you've got 1st and 2nd Chronicles, a retelling of it all. But there's much more to the centrality of the monarchy than those several books there. And one way of looking at it is the Torah is almost the prequel. It's one way of, this isn't the only way to think about Torah, folks, but think of it this way. Torah is a prequel. It's a ramp to get you where? To get you to Canaan.
Right.
That's where the story, it gets there in Exodus, and they're in, you know, they're on Mount Sinai, and then the whole point is to prepare to go into the land to do what? To be Israel.
To be a people, which has a certain, a way of organizing itself.
Right, yeah.
To be a nation. Political, yeah. To be a nation.
Right.
And then, so that's the Torah, and then on the backside of that, we all have this whole corpus of books that we call the prophets.
Yeah.
And those, if you read most of the prophets, how they begin are in this year of this king's reign. So it's happening in the same time period. Mm-hmm. It's the monarchic time period.
Right.
And it's usually the kings are doing some not so great things, and it's going to lead to some bad things if we don't do something about it.
Yeah, the prophetic books, you know, what Christians tend to call the prophetic books. Jews call them the latter prophets, right?
Right.
The former prophets
are the Samuel Kings.
Or what we call the, quote, historical books. And there's something telling about that for Judaism, both of those sections have sort of lessons to learn from, you
right.
know, and there's a prophetic nature to Samuel Kings. But be that as it may, the prophetic books, what Christians call the prophetic books, there are 17 of them. In our corpus, there's the Minor Prophets, the Book of the 12. We had a nice podcast about that. Mm-hmm. And then the five books, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, with Lamentations thrown in there after Jeremiah. Those books are all concerned with the period from like the late 8th century BCE into the exilic and near post-exilic period. So it's basically, what does that come out to in terms of like maybe 200 years roughly from the 720s, 730s down to, let's say, roughly for argument's mm-hmm. sake, around 500 or maybe a little later than that. So
right.
maybe 250 years. And then you have the books that deal with the monarchy, like we said, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, and 1 and Kings, 2 Kings. You've got a large chunk of the Hebrew Bible that's focused on one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Are we a nation or aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
And then you throw in, you would talk about Torah being a ramp to get to Sinai, which is to get to Canaan. And then what are Joshua and Judges about? It's about securing the land, dividing the land.
Right.
Why? Because now, finally, we have a king.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's minimized sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not about predicting Jesus. It's about the monarchy. How did we get there? How did we lose it? Now that we're back in the land.
And how do we get back there?
And let's make sure this never happens again.
Right.
Let's not screw up. That's where, I mean, not to jump around too much, but that's where like Ezra and Nehemiah come in, because it's like, okay, let's get this Torah thing down,
mm-hmm.
you know, and
mm-hmm.
all these rules to make sure we're complicit with the covenant, so that we don't find ourselves in a foreign land again. I think that's really, really important to understand that. That is what drives the biblical story. It's about land. It's about political organization, which is understood as the very thing that your God will do for you.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a nation with kings and a temple and a standing army and things like that, that is the pinnacle of what it means to be a people worshiping a particular God. The Israelites aren't the only ones who thought that.
Right. All right. Before we get too far in, then there's two things I think that would be worth talking about. One is, let's define what we mean by monarchy. But then two, I think going through the story of the monarchic period, because there's so many things that can throw us off and gets really confusing. I think that's why a lot of people also kind of bypass some of this. It's like, well, there's so many kings and there's names, and I get so confused on what's actually happening in the story because I get bogged down with the names. But let's start with, what do we mean by monarchy? Because we're talking about it as being central to the Hebrew Bible, but I don't know if everyone knows what that means.
Yeah, it means having a king over you.
Right.
Which all the nations did. And that's one of the cries for the Israelites, saying we want a king like every other nation has. And there's a little discrepancy in the Bible, whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, which is part of the beauty of the Bible. In Deuteronomy, it's like, assume that's going to be the case. Just make sure you pick one of your own people and make sure that person, you know, reads the law all the time. But in 1 Samuel, it's like, oh gosh, you want a king? That's the worst thing you could possibly do. And Samuel's mad about it. And God says, don't worry, Samuel, don't be so upset. They've not rejected you. They're rejecting me.
Right.
So tell them what's going to happen when they have a king. It's going to be an absolute abject disaster, mm-hmm. right? So you have these different views already in the Bible about monarchy, but the point is we have a king on the throne. That king has a military responsibility, has an economic responsibility,
religious responsibility.
Spiritual, mm-hmm. religious responsibility. They're not priests.
Right.
Technically speaking, but you know, in some biblical stories, David's very involved in getting the temple built.
Right.
That's in Chronicles, actually. That's not in the other books, but the lines are not super clear. But this is someone that's so important. Psalm 2 refers to the coronation of the king. That's not really the right word, but the coronation of the king as being declared son of God.
Right.
So son of God is not really divine language. It's royal language.
Well, and you bring up a good point, because when we talk about the center of the Hebrew Bible as being monarchy, I think we can easily misconstrue what is talked about in the New Testament with Jesus being Messiah in messianic language, mm-hmm. if we don't understand how tied that is to the idea of the monarchy in the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
Messiah, we over-spiritualize it as something right. disconnected from the monarchy.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, jumping to the New Testament, it's pretty clear. Like, read the first couple of chapters of Luke's gospel, the birth narrative, and then the whole, you know, Zechariah, John the Baptist thing, and Mary singing a song to Elizabeth, all kind of stuff. It's really, really clear that the notion of the birth of this child by Mary is an anointed one, which means relieving the people of their distress, of their persecution and oppression in that context at the hands of the Romans. So right. that is still a very active idea, that's the role of kings, to protect the people and to deliver them, to save them, to redeem them, use all that language you want to. Right. And that is something that very much echoes this monarchic period that we're talking about. It's right. brought right into that Second Temple and New Testament period.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about, before we move on to kind of walking through the story, when we talk about the centrality of the monarchy, what we're saying is it really, a huge portion of the Hebrew Bible is dealing directly or indirectly with kingship
mm-hmm.
and the behavior of the kings.
Right. I'd say the only books that aren't dealing with it as much are probably things like Job.
The wisdom literature.
The wisdom literature. Proverbs assumes a monarchic context,
right?
Ecclesiastes is written, you know, by, quote, Solomon, even though that's never said in the book. It's sort of, there's a kingly persona, and Psalms have kingly kinds of psalms in them,
right.
and, you know, how many did David write, and those kinds of things. So, and Song of Songs, whatever's going on with that. But, you know, you have maybe some echoes, but they don't contribute to the narrative of kingship. The books that contribute to the narrative of kingship are really Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, Chronicles, and then all the prophetic literature. And I would throw in books like Ruth, because the point is a genealogy of David at the end. Ezra, Nehemiah, it's still very much land kingship oriented, because we're coming back to the land and what's this going to look like now, even though the Persians were in charge and they really couldn't just set up a king, but the hope was there
yeah.
to get back to the way things were.
So I know you're nerdy about this, so I'm going to try to keep you high level, because I think let's stay at the high touch points of the monarchy so that we can give people a timeline here of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So let's try to help people, because I know it'd be great if we could have a PowerPoint here and all that jazz, but you know, this is a podcast, it's audio.
It's
so
a
what
podcast,
are we going to do? We got to create the PowerPoint with our words.
People have to do their own PowerPoint.
Yeah, we should do like a contest.
A contest!
Yeah, have everyone send in their PowerPoint of what we're about to say.
to see how poorly we've communicated.
Exactly. Yeah. So let's start with the beginning. Where would we say, again, I'm going to ask you to get rid of all your nerdiness because I know you might want to do some prologue, and let's talk about, we have to talk about Joshua. We're not going to talk about Joshua. We're not going to talk about Judges. We're going to talk about when do we get a king and who's the first king?
How about the Marvel movies? Can we get that in there somehow? Because I just watched all of them. Sabbatical. Okay. Anyway. Yeah. Let's start around the year 1000.
1000. That's a good round place to start from.
It's not absolutely precise, but it's not.
It's bad. Close enough.
1000 is around the time of David.
Right.
So Saul is the first king anointed by Samuel. Right. So you put him a little bit earlier. A few decades before.
And Saul is presented as almost like this proto king. Like not. Things haven't really been established.
Right.
Sort of anointed under a tree. It feels a little tribal still.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's a little before 1000. And then we get David, who's really, the narrative unifies the tribes even further, really makes this into what we would consider a kingship.
Or at least getting there.
Right.
I mean, a lot of people think of David as, king, but still maybe just a step up from Saul being
right.
a really
it is
a
evolutionary.
Tribal warlord
yes.
kind of thing
yes.
like that. And David does come across as a bit of a ruthless warlord here and there.
Yeah, that's true. But
yeah. We've had podcasts on that.
Well, we're going to have... Oh,
we have another one.
Yeah, we are going to have another.
Awesome. Fantastic. Okay.
So we have Saul
let's not talk about David.
I know, exactly. Okay. We got to keep the mystery alive.
I know, keep the mystery alive.
So a few decades before 1000 BCE, we have Saul. Around 1000, we have David. And it's progressing in terms of how sophisticated and how organized the courts are and the kingship is.
Yes.
And then we get Solomon.
You get Solomon. And that, I think you'd have to say from the way he's described in 1 Kings, he is the first
true king
of Israel because he has a tax system, right? Mm-hmm. He now has a unified place of worship that David set up. This is in Jerusalem, the capital. He has, it's in 1 Kings 4, a list of administrators. Boring. Yeah, it sort of is, but still, that's very important. Mm-hmm. And he does kingly kinds of things. He's wise.
Right.
That's mm-hmm. we're seeing here a picture portraying an ancient Near Eastern, successful ancient Near Eastern
right.
king. Now, there are some issues with that from a historical point of view. Is this an exaggeration? Right. Maybe, but that's the story.
Even regardless of the history or the narrative, because within one generation, we don't have a successor to Solomon within the unified kingdom.
Yeah.
Right? So we get Saul, who's not really a king. We get David, who's getting there closer. We get Solomon, first real king. Yay, the dynasty begins. Mm-hmm. And then what happens
it
after that?
It all falls apart. And there are different ways of looking at that from within the biblical story. But one of which is that Solomon was really stupid at mm-hmm. some point. Solomon himself, let's put it this way, he wasn't really that stupid, but he did use the northerners. See, he's from Judah. He's from the south. That's where the kingship is located. Jerusalem is basically in the south. It's right next to Judah. He was using the northerners for conscripted labor, and that probably wasn't a smart move because it created tensions.
Right.
So you have these north-south tensions, and I tell my students, not unlike in the American experience, the Civil War happened, there was already a fissure there for where that line was going to be drawn. So.
Yeah, and I think that's important to note that sometimes we get the sense that there's this unified nation, but there were tensions throughout. Between the tribes, and then specifically between the north and the south.
Right.
And so by the time we get to Solomon's, the next generation, to Rehoboam and Jeroboam, we actually now have a divide.
Right. So you have Solomon's son is Rehoboam,
mm-hmm.
and he assumes the throne. And so Jeroboam is sort of like the agreed upon guy to come and bring some others to talk some sense into Rehoboam, saying, listen, your dad really wasn't very fair. We'd love to work with you. And if we can just feel like we're being treated fair, let's do this. And so he says, I'll get back to you. So Rehoboam confers with the elders, and they're saying, listen to what they're telling you. This could avert a disaster. Do what they say. And he says, yeah, that's great. So then he talks to the younger guys.
Then he talks to his bros.
Yeah, his Theo bros.
That's right.
his college buddies.
What do the old guys know? They don't know anything.
No. And they said, no, bro, don't do that, bro.
You're the kid. You got to put your mark on this. Yep.
This is your time to shine, man. You know, so they have this wonderful line that I let my students figure out. Basically, let them know that your little finger is bigger than your father's thigh. Now, thigh, folks, I don't know if you're listening to this with your children, but I'm going to let you guess what thigh is a euphemism for.
And so basically, little fingers and thighs. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's portrayed that way because it's, I think readers are meant to see what a bunch of, how could this possibly happen? So anyway, so that's exactly the advice that Rehoboam took. Mm-hmm. And when Jeroboam came back, he could see what was happening. He said, you know, Israel, to your tents. In other words, the dividing lines were already broken. And that's when you have these two nations, two separate nations, right, that will each have their own capital. The northern capital became Samaria,
right,
which is known. And they had to have their own.
You might have heard of the Samaritans.
Yes, exactly. That's where the idea comes from. It's after the name of the capital. And they had their own, obviously their own army. They had their own religious system. They had to. You can't just survive.
And this is within 100 years or so, exactly, yeah, of Solomon.
Yeah. But, well, it's Solomon. It's within 100 years of Saul.
Of Saul, right. Yeah. Right.
I mean, if you think like roughly, I mean, this is all stylized, but 40 years for each of the three reigns, it's like 120 years. That's right, the biblical, right, timeline. So around 930 is typically a rough date. It could be in the 920s.
For the split of the two kingdoms.
For the split, right.
Yep.
And that split lasts
for the rest of for the next 200 years.
200 years it lasts.
Yep. Because then, so that's good. Let's go there, because I think that's important. Because high level, there's a lot going on up front. We got Saul, we got David, we got Solomon, we got that split between Rehoboam and Jeroboam in 930. And that continues for 200 years until Assyria comes, 722.
Yeah.
Assyria carts the north off.
Exactly, right.
And now we just have the southern kingdom.
Now the southern kingdom is left, right?
And then
200 years.
Yep.
Right? And during those 200 years in the north, again, how much of this is strictly history? There's a lot of history happening here that's been, right, verified, but it's hard to know exactly if this is like objective history. But you have 20 kings of the north lasting 200 years, and it's not just one line. It's all these series of coups.
Right.
Right. There's a lot of bloodshed in the north where just kings would last for like 6 days and they'd be hacked to bits and then somebody else would take over and they'd rule for 3-4 generations. It was like that. You had several different bloodlines. The south, Judah, they also had their 20 kings, but that dynasty lasted another 150 years roughly, you know, until 586.
Right. So again, timeline is 722, the north is carted off by Assyria, the south stays until the Babylonians then,
right,
take over the Assyrians, and then they come for the south, and in 586, that's the exile.
That's the exile.
And that's a critical moment,
yeah,
in understanding these parts of the Bible. When we talk about exile, that's what we're talking about.
Right.
722 Assyria, 586 Babylon in the south. And those are critical crisis moments in the history of Israel in the north and Judah in the south.
Yeah. And when the north fell, it's hard to know exactly how the south would have reacted. I mean, we just have this official literature, but, you know, there are theories about how northerners would come down and bring their own traditions. Remember, they've been separated for like 200 years, which is almost
how long as America.
Country. Exactly, yeah, right. So they developed their own traditions in the north, and
it's almost like England is in the north.
Yes.
America is the south, right? Like we were used to be united, now that we're split, and you can see how the different traditions and language even and culture.
Imagine America falls and we say, you know, we got to go back to England, right?
Right?
So you go back and we wouldn't just like not have had 200 years of, if we can even call it culture, whatever we've had here in America, right? So, you know, those two things are going to sort of merge and talk to each other. And getting really off the field here, but it ties in with stuff we've talked about in other podcasts. That is one of the really convincing, compelling theories for these different sources in Torah. The northern traditions, again, you don't, there's no test here, but if you've listened to some of the podcasts, the E source is supposedly a northern source that comes from that northern influence that was brought together with the J source, which is more southern. And those things were sort of negotiated and brought mm-hmm. together to have one tradition. So there was probably a sense of camaraderie among people. Now, the writer of First of Kings is like, well, they got what they deserved. Those mm-hmm. stupid northerners start breaking off from us, not listening to us, and starting their own religion.
So Kings has a bit of a bias.
Yes, he has an axe to grind. He really does. Mm-hmm. And the axe to grind is God punishes cultic unfaithfulness.
That's right.
Cultic meaning
comes back
with
to
worship.
We set up these places, the high places. They don't follow the Deuteronomic understanding of how you're supposed to worship.
Like the book of Deuteronomy.
Like right. Book of Deuteronomy says. So, of course, they get carted off. They've been worshiping illegitimately for a couple of hundred years now.
Yeah.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive. Dein T-Rock. Rockt. Der neue T-Rock.
Dein altes Sofa zerfällt langsam. Und die Black-Friday-Angebote sind wirklich unschlagbar. Aber dein Gehalt kommt erst Anfang des Monats. Kein Problem. Mit der PayPal-Bezahlung nach 30 Tagen. So hast du jetzt mehr Spielraum beim Bezahlen und der Betrag wird nach 30 Tagen automatisch und kostenlos von deinem Konto oder deiner Karte abgebucht. Alle Infos auf paypal.de/30 Tage. PayPal es. Vorbehaltlich Kreditwürdigkeitsprüfung verfügbar mit deutschem PayPal-Konto für Einkäufe zwischen 1 und 2.000 Euro.
But then the South gets carted off too. So
what gives?
What's up with that? Well, that's how the story continues. Mm-hmm. You have essentially in the South a line of kings who likewise, they don't have their acts together. And some of them are really, really, really bad. One good one is Hezekiah. He's a good one. He's around the year 700. He's a great king. And by the way,
Before you go on with Hezekiah, yes. Note, 700 is the North's already been carted off.
Exactly right. But you know what? The North is not like saying, okay, we're done here. Let's go home. They had their sights on the rest of the area. And that is, you know, one of the most, frankly, amazing scenes in the whole Hebrew Bible is the unsuccessful Assyrian attack on Jerusalem, and that happened in 701 BC, and Hezekiah was the king. Surely there's a reason for that. Hezekiah must be this great, amazing king who's walking with God, and so you have the result is a very good result. And so he is presented as not a perfect king, but a really, really, really good one.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and that helps explain why he was able to ward off the Assyrian attack on Jerusalem in 701.
That's right. And I think we should, from a historian's point of view, again, people can disagree who are listening, and that's fine, but we're talking about biblical scholarship and things. That is the way that historians understand this episode. Hezekiah is portrayed a certain way by the biblical writers to connect this idea that the righteous are rewarded and the wicked are punished. Retributional theology.
The story of the kings is written through the prism or the lens of retributive or Deuteronomic theology,
exactly.
Meaning if you do good things, you get to stay in the land and God will prosper the king and through the king, the people.
Right.
If you disobey the Deuteronomic laws, then you will be punished. The kings will be punished, and there through them, the people will be punished.
And that's in Deuteronomy. That's why we keep saying this Deuteronomic perspective.
Yeah, that's outlined in the book of Deuteronomy.
Right. Towards the end, the blessings and curses. There's a lot of like hint, hint, hint exile language in Deuteronomy, which is what leads people to think Deuteronomy was written in light of exile, which I happen to agree with. I know you do
right.
too. So,
yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's really all these things are sort of woven together. But the South were the good guys, basically. They kept going, right? Until this guy, Manasseh, showed up. And he was a king in the 7th century, like the middle of the century, 7th century. And he had, I'm trying to remember exactly how long, it was like 45 or 50 years. He had the longest reign of any king.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the worst.
Yeah.
He did everything you shouldn't do, setting up alternate cultic sites, erecting high places, which Deuteronomy is like really clear. Now, you want to tear those things down. He kept erecting these high places.
So now, just to clarify, when you're in the north, you don't have access to the temple in Jerusalem.
You don't.
So if you want to worship Yahweh, you have to set up high places.
Right.
But if you're in the south, you really have no excuse for setting up cultic places.
You got the stupid temple right there, guys.
So Manasseh was like doubly bad.
Doubly bad, right. Which, by the way, was following a little bit in Solomon's footsteps, because Solomon had all these foreign wives. And another reason given in 1 Kings for why there was a split in the monarchy, it's not just the Rehoboam-Jeroboam thing. It's Solomon basically was disobedient by, he got all full of himself. He had these foreign wives because he had to be nice to them. You let them worship their own gods in the Holy Land the way they want to. And that's why the kingdom was torn away from him. So you have, which I think is a beautiful thing. Part of what makes this literature actually very interesting is you have a theological explanation, Solomon's infidelity to God, basically his spiritual adultery. And you also have a political answer given for why it split. And that's basically Rehoboam
mishandled the succession.
Was unwise.
Yep.
He was a fool. He was unlike his father early on, he was unwise. And both of those are juxtaposed. They're right next to each other in the narrative. Well, which is it? Well, that's the wrong question. It's
right.
From their perspective, both of these things are active. Which means, I think there's a subtlety there that we sometimes lose when we're too critical about, oh, they just think God caused everything. I think they had a sense for, there are theological reasons behind the scenes, but then there are also political reasons that are right in front of us. And I think they're acknowledging both,
right.
Which means they're a lot more sophisticated, I think, in their religious thinking than we sometimes give them credit
for. Well, it reminds me, for some reason, of going back to Genesis with, say, the flood narrative, where it's... We don't say God, everything, God's behind everything. So it's not that it's either or, it's that God is acting in the midst of these other actions.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever there's a political reason, that's fine, but clearly there's always a theological reason as well.
Yeah, like the Babylonians coming to invade Judah and carrying them off, it's like...
That's obviously a political reality.
It's a political reality because they're just doing their thing, but it's also something that Yahweh is somehow behind.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So you have Manasseh, who's the worst king ever, and it got so bad that he caused his children to, quote, pass through the fire, which is he reinstituted child sacrifice, which that and worshiping false gods are about the two worst things you can do in Deuteronomic theology. And he's got them both. So what happens is that he dies, and his grandson, Josiah, who is by far the best king in all of these stories— And what he does is he completely cleans house. He has a revival. He reinstitutes things like the Passover, which had been forgotten. He undoes everything that his grandfather did. But still, see, this is the thing, but still, exile came.
How far after Josiah do we have Babylon coming?
Pretty much right after he dies.
Right.
Yeah, he dies. By the way, unlike his grandfather Manasseh, the wicked one, Josiah, super king, he gets killed in a really dumb battle in a really dumb way. He gets himself involved in some political machinations and he gets killed. You know, the Babylonians are coming from there, the Egyptians from the south. He wants to get in the way to sort of, you know, keep... He wants the Egyptians out of the way, and he wants the devil you know, I think, is better than the devil you don't know. So the Pharaoh Necho is his name. I always think of him because it's the candy too. But yep. Pharaoh Necho comes in and winds up killing Josiah in battle, and he's brought back, and there's great mourning. But the thing is, like, he's not supposed to die.
Right. We have a theological crisis.
We have a theological
crisis. Because Manasseh,
crisis.
The evil king, survives forever.
Right.
And has a long reign, and then the good king Josiah dies younger than he should in a dumb military battle.
And not a good because he undid everything that Manasseh
did. And he's a good king.
And so here is how the author explains this problem. He says, yeah, we still go into exile because despite what Josiah did, Manasseh's sins were so bad, God just could not overlook those.
Right.
And
like the tidal wave of sin that Manasseh, you know, that Manasseh's earthquake, it couldn't be undone. The wall couldn't be built fast enough.
Even though Josiah undid it.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So the exile comes anyway. And I've always found that to be a little bit of a lame excuse. I mean, it reeks a little bit of propaganda. You know, again, we have to explain, we have to defend God here. Why would God do this? Well, clearly this sin must be so bad. So you cart people off.
Can we talk for a minute? This may get us off track, but I always love this juxtaposition because it really helps. Talk about the difference that how Chronicles presents Manasseh versus how Kings presents Manasseh.
Yeah, I mean, this is not just this, but a lot of the other kings. The story in Chronicles. Okay, back up. First and Second Kings is written in the context of probably the exile itself.
Well, it's asking the question, why are we in exile? It's very exilic.
Right, and yeah. It gives the answer.
Right.
And Chronicles is probably written, well, generations later, and I'm guessing probably, you know, others say this too, but probably like 4th century.
Like very late.
Like really, really late, right? And we know this because there are 5th century names in that boring genealogy we all skip at the beginning of First Chronicles. It's 9 chapters of names. There are 5th century names in there. So the writing of this has to be, it can't be any earlier than probably mid to late 5th century.
Right.
And so it might even be 4th century. So,
what I think, look, I'm just going to, again, side note on this, because I think it's telling that in the Jewish Bible, we put Chronicles in with the history books.
Yeah.
In the Jewish Bible, they have 3 sections, right? They have your Torah, you have your prophets, and then you have your writings.
Yeah.
Which are sort of, the writings are usually later and they're put at the end. And Chronicles is in the writings.
Yeah, Chronicles in the Jewish is in Bible. The writings, yeah.
Because it's written much later.
Yeah.
And it's clearly a reinterpretation of things.
It's a reinterpretation of history as we move forward in our existence.
Now we are trying to figure out, are we still God's people after exile? And we have to rethink that narrative we have in Samuel Kings about all of that happened.
We have to reframe the whole narrative in order to speak to our circumstance today. And that's why, you know, Chronicles is last in the Jewish canon.
We end with Second Chronicles.
It's a great send-off.
Yep.
It's a great way to end the Hebrew Bible. It's like, and now the future, you know, what's going to happen?
And also why it starts with pages and pages of genealogy.
Right.
Because we're trying to connect our story now to the glory days in some ways.
Well, back to Adam. That's right. The first name. It's like, here's an overview of our entire people and what it means.
Because we're trying to find connections now, because after the exile, things just don't feel the same.
Yeah.
We are supposed to be all triumphant, and then we get back to the land and it just doesn't feel like the glory days.
Right. But they're coming.
Right.
See, that's the idea, they're coming. And with Manasseh, it's a fascinating story, because in Kings, he is horrible and wicked, and then he dies like he deserves.
Mm-hmm.
Sheds a lot of blood. He's horrible, right? In Chronicles, he's wicked and horrible, but then what happens is he gets captured and he's brought to Assyria. He's taken into exile. And while he's there, he says,
lo and behold,
I've been wrong.
He repents.
He repents. He repents. That's the story. Mm-hmm. And as a result, he comes back and has a change of heart and things get better. Now, God still punished them because the people were complicit.
Well, you still have to explain the exile.
You still have to explain the exile. You still have to explain why things didn't just become rosy. Mm-hmm. But I think the point, the way I've interpreted this story has been, and again, I'm not the only person to say this, but Manasseh now becomes an object lesson for these Jews living so much later, saying, you know what? If you repent of your sins, God will bless you. So there's always, God is always ready to hear a repentant heart. And then that is what it's needed to, as we move into the future, look at Manasseh and the example of even Manasseh.
If there's hope for Manasseh, there is hope for us.
There's no hope in Kings. He's the culprit, right? Chronicles portrays Manasseh in a way that, in my opinion, is not historically justifiable.
Which, for a lot of Chronicles, is the case.
That is the case, yeah. I mean, some people disagree, although nuance it differently, but there could be a debate about this. But I think Manasseh, the very idea of him being taken captive by the Assyrians, I just don't know why Kings would leave that out. Because that's like, that's what he deserved.
Right.
But it's just, he dies and there's a succession and that's all there is to it. It seems fabricated on the part of Chronicle. Well, I shouldn't say fabricated. That's a modern bias. He's preaching the life of Manasseh and doing it in such a way they'll benefit the people and the lessons that they need to hear hundreds of years later.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and it's, in that sense, it's really a beautiful story, but they treat him differently. He's just this figure you have to account for somehow and treats him differently.
Yep.
Right. So Josiah dies, and that's when the Babylonian invasion starts, because the Babylonians defeat the Egyptians. They have they're running the show now. And it starts like in the 590s, slow, like attrition, right, that sort of keeps up for about, you know, 10 years or so. And then Jerusalem fell and the temple was razed to the ground around 586.
Right.
And that is the exile, which lasted
70 years?
Well, that's what they say.
So 539, right? Cyrus issues the decree.
Yeah, although that's 47 years.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I just didn't do the math right. 539 issues the decree.
Well, they say 70, because Jeremiah,
right? Yeah,
talks
that's
about 70 years,
right?
Right.
Right.
And a lot of people think, and I think this is probably the easiest answer, that it's a round number.
Right.
It's a number of perfection. It's a number of divine intentionality or something like that. There is another answer that my Old Testament professor, Ray Dillard, mentioned once. Just in passing, he said it might be this. He argued that the temple wasn't rebuilt until 516, around that period. So 586 to 516 is around 70 years.
And that's, quote, the exile, because we're exiled from the temple, basically, in
right.
some ways. Yeah.
Until God is back in our midst. It's not the land, right? And that's always attracted me. And I sort of have bounced this off of people. And no one has said, oh, that's wrong. They said, oh, that's really interesting. So there may be
something to that.
Yeah, and we don't have to choose between those two options either. You
know? But again, for our timeline, so again, just to go back, we got 1,000, we have the setup of the monarchy, we might say,
yeah,
in 1,000. Then by 930, we split
right.
the north and the south. 722, the north gets carted off. 586, the south gets carted off. 516, we have the beginnings of the second temple.
Yeah.
And then basically, until 1945, the Jewish people didn't have their own land.
Yeah, 47, right? Yeah.
I think maybe 47. The Jewish people didn't have their land except for this small period during the Maccabean period, we call it.
Well, they didn't have rulership of their land, but they were living in the land.
They were living there, but they didn't have
guests. So
they didn't
speak.
Have political autonomy.
Exactly right. Yeah.
And except for this little period, which I think is actually important, from about 130 BCE until 37 BCE, so we're getting close to the time of Jesus, we have this Maccabean revolt, and they do have reign over their land again until Herod the Great comes and conquers it for Rome, and then the Romans. But I think that's important. The only reason I say that is I think it's important because it can explain some of the political unrest during Jesus's time.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, we just haven't had our land for so long, and now we had it, and now we don't again.
And the thing about that roughly 100-year period is that it isn't like, and they all lived happily ever after because now they have their kingdom back. Man, there was infighting. There was negotiating with the Greeks, you know, about survival. And, you know, one reason where you probably have, we had a podcast on the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the Essenes, who were sort of like the monastics of the day and running off into the desert, probably left Jerusalem. They abandoned that 100-year period.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was so corrupt.
So chaotic, yeah.
Yeah, like the buying and selling of the high priesthood. And we have that information from other Second Temple texts, things that made it into the Apocrypha, which Protestants never read, which is a shame. But they talk about this kind of stuff. So this was not a return to glory days and then all of a sudden thwarted 100 years later. It was sort of a mess. It was semi-independent.
Right.
Rulership.
Right.
And there was always a problem with from within and without. So it was a lot of unrest. And then Herod the Great, you know, he took over.
Right.
Right. And that's that, you know,
leads us into the New
story
Testament
of Jesus and things
yeah.
like that. Right.
So again, I think we bring this history lesson because it can feel confusing. But if you can remember those high points of the start of the monarchy, the split into the north and the north being taken off by the Assyrians, the south being taken off by the Babylonians. That's the exile that's often talked about. Then we have a return from exile, and then we head into the New Testament, you know, a few hundred years later, this intertestamental period, Second mm-hmm. Temple period. But that gives us this, that covers a huge swath of our Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
That time frame.
First and Second Samuel, First and Second Kings, the 17 books that make up the prophets for us. So that's right. 21 books.
And then First and Second Chronicles.
First and Second
Those
Chronicles.
Those are direct. Those are right. like directly addressing
that's them. 22, 23 books. You have to throw in Ezra and Nehemiah, 24-25, Mazel Throne Ruth, 26. Esther is taking place in the Persian period, even though there are, quote, historical problems with that. You've got, you know, an awful lot of the biblical books that are contributing to what is the main historical narrative of the Hebrew Bible, which is from creation to exile. That's really the that's the whole historical context. Most of the books of the Hebrew Bible, there are whatever 39 books.
And so we said 27 of them. 20,
and actually, you know, if you play with it a little bit, it's really just those five books of wisdom, literature, and poetry that don't directly connect to the timeline, the episodes. The rest of it, in some sense, is dealing with the stories of Genesis, which are already previewing monarchy. You know, I have a solo podcast on a different way of reading Genesis. I forgot what number it is, but find it. You people are capable on the interwebs. You can find these things. You know, where there are already monarchic overtones in Genesis, because that's the signal. All this stuff, this is where this story is going. So you have the ramp up to the books that we discussed starting in 1 Samuel. Right. And all the prophets are dealing with essentially threats to the existence of the monarchy from within and from without. And what are we going to do about these things?
Right. So again, the reason we wanted to talk about this was because as we read our Bibles, it's important to understand that's what you're getting yourself into. When you flip open to the Old Testament, chances are you're flipping open to a historical narrative or an interpretation of historical events that directly tie to the kingship of Israel.
Mm-hmm. And maybe the question, it's a little simplistic because people read the Bible for different reasons and they get different things out of it, which I totally affirm. But maybe this is an instance where trying to understand the biblical theology, these are historical, like they're dealing with history, but they are fundamentally pieces of theology. What is God like? What does it mean to be the people of God? How does this all work? And we're eavesdropping almost on their understanding of what those things mean. And let's just say, and again, somewhat simplistically, there are lessons to be learned there, but that's only a part of the story of the entire Christian scriptures, which goes beyond these moments during the monarchic period. And Jesus is supposed to be the ideal king, sort of like David was, but you know, that's the problem again, by these stories get sanitized a little bit, but Jesus as king, as Messiah, there's a whole history behind the centrality of this sort of thing. And then to watch how Jesus essentially, according to the Gospels, undermines the whole thing. That is one, to me, that's a really interesting thing to look at, not just the monarchic period for itself, although that's interesting. If you're interested in like, oh, well, what do I get out of it? You have to keep reading the whole thing and how the old ways are played with in the Gospels, and Jesus comes out looking not at all like you would expect someone hailed as the Jewish king to act. That's how Jesus is presented.
Right. Well, I think ending with Jesus is a good place to end.
Yes, as always.
So thanks so much for listening, everyone, and we'll be back in 2 weeks.
2 weeks. See you, folks.
You just made it through another entire episode of The Bible for Normal People. Well done to you. And well done to everyone who supports us by rating the podcast, leaving us a review, or telling others about our show. We are especially grateful for our producers group who support us over on Patreon. They are the reason we are able to keep bringing podcasts and other content to you. So a big thanks to Jeremy Jones, Becky Davenport, Mike, Edward Glasscock, Dustin Bauckham, Phil Spahn, Chris Abbott, Michelle Oney Snyder, Stephen Goldstone, and Kevin Marshall.
This episode was brought to you by the Bible for Normal People team, Brittany Prescott, Savannah Locke, Stephanie Spate, Tessa Stoltz, Nick Striegel, Haley Warren, Jessica Shao, and Natalie Wyand.